Thank you very much, Louise. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. This is the IRTPB call on the 27th of September, 2011. On the line today, we have Bob Mountain, Mike O'Connor, Michaela Nayland, Kevin Erdman, James Bodell, Barry Cobb, Anil George, Barbara Steele, Matt Berlin. For ICANN staff, we have Mirka Koenigs and myself, Natalie Peregrin. We also have apologies from Paul Diaz, Simonetta Batiga, Chris Chaplow. Please remember to say your name before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you very much, and over to you.
Thanks. Good afternoon, everybody. It's been a while since we've had a meeting. So, let's see. Has everybody had an opportunity to read over the documents that Marika circulated? Or to get a better answer out of you, does anybody have any questions? Does anybody have any queries about the documents that were circulated? James, go ahead, please.
Hi, Michaeli. Thanks. It's James speaking. I don't really know what constitutes a question or a query. I have two comments about one for each document. So,
comment is good, James.
Well, I just didn't know. Do you want to read through them? Do you want to just take them? Just want us to just fire away, or?
Well, I'm a strong believer in. I think the thing is, some people obviously have read through them and have provided comments to the list and are on this call. Some people might not have read through them. Some people might have very strong feelings. Some people might have no feelings at all. So I just thought I'd kick it off by just seeing if anybody has anything they want to share, and you volunteered.
Okay. So I want to echo something that Paul posted on the list, I believe, while I was traveling last week, and that is in regard to the first document and the first the language, the drafted language that's been posted here. And that is that I don't believe we have sufficient safeguards or carve-out or whatever you want to call it in that language for situations where the registrar has locked a name for a legitimate purpose and the registrant does not particularly like it. Example, UDRP, law enforcement action, other administrative or fraudulent type activities. I don't know if there's language existing somewhere else that we can borrow from to set up some provisos and qualifiers to this language, but I think that we need to make sure that we are not giving bad actors another tool. That's all.
Okay, I believe Marika might have a response for you.
Yes, this is Marika. Maybe just to clarify that the new language is really intended to cover a registrar log that is placed on the domain at the specific request of the registered name holder, nothing more. So the revised denial reason 6, as well as a new language that has been proposed, from a staff perspective, they do not override any of the other valid reasons for denial that are still in the transfer policy. But obviously, if the working group thinks that additional qualifications or clarifications might be required, we're more than welcome to suggest edits that might help to clarify that.
Okay. Just a couple of other questions. I put my hand down, but if that's okay, Michaeli.
Oh, work away. Might as well let you get it off your chest.
Okay.
With the 50 million domains. Go on.
So understood that we are working through locks that are applied by the registrant or with the consent or opt-in or whatever of the registrant. And that is probably okay. The question I get to then is there's a difference between, I think, there's a difference between a registrar applying a lock versus a registrar issuing a NAC for a domain name transfer. And I think that we may have commingled the two here by saying that the lock can be applied legitimately for the same reasons that a registrar might NAC a domain name or deny a transfer. Is that did I follow you correctly, or am I missing something?
What's a NAC?
I'm sorry, denial of a transfer.
Okay.
It's the opposite of an NAC, which is an acknowledgement of a transfer.
Yeah, non-acknowledgement of a transfer. I'm sorry. So we have these reasons for denial, and I just want to point out that that's different. A registrar denying a transfer request is different than a registrar blocking the transfer request in the first place.
Marika?
This is Marika. I don't think I really understanding James's question, because the provision specifically deals with locks that are applied on the request of a registrant. So basically, your question is that, you know, if the registrant requests a lock to be applied, that you can deny applying that lock if there are other valid reasons not for doing so, or you're asking the question the other way around, that if the domain name is locked and a registrant asks to unlock it under this provision, that you are not allowed to deny it because...
No, I guess, the way I understood your explanation is that if we had a reason to lock a domain name and we locked it and the registrant said, I request that you unlock that domain name. You have 5 days according to this policy. And then we unlock the domain name, and they try to transfer, and then we deny the transfer because something else is going on. It's a law enforcement, it's fraud, it's, it's UDRP. This is what I'm getting at is, I think we'd rather have the lock in place in those situations than to deny the transfer after the fact. Maybe we can go through the queue. Maybe some other folks in the queue have some other light they can shed on this. But I just think
I think
the language of the... I'm sorry?
No, I think I understand your question now. And again, I think it would maybe be helpful to provide some language that you think might clarify that situation. And indeed, it would be interesting to see if others see it as a similar issue that indeed, locking the undoing of the lock or denying the transfer, the difference between those, how that can be addressed.
So, this is Michele. I mean, the first email notification you get from WIPO or the National Arbitration Forum, whatever they're called, asks you as the registrar of record to confirm that the domain is locked against transfer, not that you are going to deny transfer requests. I'll move down the queue. Anil and then Mikey. Go ahead, Anil.
So to the question that you guys are talking about, I'm just curious, and you can share your input, is there anything here that would be inconsistent with what would happen if there's a UDRP proceeding? So is there something here that during a UDRP, you don't officially use the term lock, but from the registrant isn't permitted to transfer the domain, and the registrar doesn't transfer to another registrar unless they agree that that the UDRP will still. Unless they accept the UDRP will continue and apply to them. So I'm just curious, based on the prior comments, is there enough safeguards here to avoid something that's inconsistent with what I just stated about the UDRP?
That's my concern, Anil. It's James speaking.
Okay. And I'm wondering, if it's a matter of clarifying that the actions here, adding language that the actions here should be consistent with the provisions provided under the UDRP policy, or that it should be consistent with and not contrary to, or something like that to make sure that there's some type of... something that would catch that type of action that could fall through the cracks.
Does anybody have any specific comments on it? If not, I'm going to read what James has put in the chat, which is he's just reiterating that he likes Paul Diaz's suggestion of legal administrative process. what Paul was saying is that Network Solutions supports the draft proposals as long as the 5-day turnaround does not automatically overrule a lock that was put in place due to some valid legal or administrative process. And just to confirm, I dragged out an email from the National Arbitration Forum, and the third question they ask is, and they use the term lock, confirmation that each domain name, as referenced in point one of their email, is on a registrar lock or its equivalent, preventing the domain names from being transferred. So it's not simply a question of denying the transfer request. Mikey, go ahead.
Michaeli, is what you read in these documents or a subsequent email?
Which did I read, sorry?
The thing referring to the legal administrative process?
That's a note that Paul Diaz posted to the mailing list.
Okay, thank you.
And it's summarized in the Adobe chat in the notes.
Okay.
That Marika put up. Marika, do you want to skip ahead of Mikey very quickly?
No, this isn't Marika. Just to comment, that definitely wasn't the intention, I think, of the language that has been proposed to indeed avoid those situations. And you know, I'm happy to take that point back as well to internally to see indeed if there are any further clarifications that need to be provided to indeed ensure that in those cases where a lock is applied for other reasons, such as you know, indeed UDRP cases, that you know, this 5-day unlocking doesn't apply. And so again, if someone has any suggestions, you know, I'll look as well at I'll take back as well Paul's language, and I'll discuss that internally further.
Okay, thanks, Mikey. Go ahead.
This is Mikey. I think mostly I want to back this thread. I had a specific comment, but it got covered. So I'm in favor of where we're headed with this, that Marika takes this back. It's a little hard to do this on the fly, and you know, I think it needs thought, because we could make a pretty serious mistake if we do this and leave a loophole. So thanks, James, for bringing that up, and I'll support the outcome.
Okay, thank you. Does anybody else have any other comments on this particular document? Anil?
Yeah, I guess to that general discussion, I just had a question, maybe just to clarify from your perspective. In the document where it lists, there's a paragraph that says, upon denying a transfer request, the registrar must provide the name holder, the gaining registrar, with the reason for the denial. And then it lists, and the list there, where it says, are all of those things, are the registrars required to deny under those circumstances, or is it just an optional thing?
In relation to UDRPs and things like that, and other administrative processes,
we
cannot allow the transfer. If we allow the transfer, that puts us in breach of our contract.
Okay.
The other things like legal things and everything else, I think that's just me speaking personally. I'm not aware of those being covered specifically in the RAA. James might have a better take on that, my understanding is UDRP is completely binding with respect to the REA. James?
Hi, Michaeli. Yeah, James speaking. All of the reasons for denial are optional at the registrar's discretion. However, Michaeli is right. The UDRP has other specific language that is mandatory. So I know it gets a little confusing. But this was part of our discussion when we were talking about the domain name was less than 60 days old or something like that, or one of the other things when we were going through the meat and potatoes of this working group. We noted that there was, I think it was reason for denial 8, and we thought, well, you know, pretty much everybody does that, even though it is, in fact, optional. But the reason
that was the 60 days after a transfer, James, I think, is the one, not 60 days after a registration.
Well, I think they were both kind of, they're both kind of standard practice for the most part, even though they are, in fact, optional.
Well, the second one is, the first one isn't.
Okay.
But anyway, never mind.
Yeah, the reason I wanted to jump in the queue is I've been typing like a madman into the text box. I think we can fix this language fairly simply by borrowing some of Paul's language and then tacking it on at the end and saying something to the effect of, you know, this does not a doesn't apply when the registrar lock was applied for legitimate legal or administrative processes or something. You know, I think that we can just, as long as we have a carve out safety net. And I understand that it's very tempting to have the certainty of a registrant being able to remove any kind of lock whenever they want from now until doomsday. But I think the real, you know, where the rubber meets the road, there are certain locks that registrants cannot remove even if they want to. And I think that by tacking on a sentence like that, Marika, we can possibly fix it.
Marika, a new hand or an old hand?
New hand.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so this is Marika. My question is, what would be a legitimate administrative process? Because I think we do want to avoid as well that we create another loophole by whereby a registrar would say, oh, well, this is an administrative process which is not clearly identified as, you know, being a valid reason why a registrant shouldn't be able to unlock their name. I guess for legitimate legal, you can identify, I guess, you know, court proceedings, you know, UDRP, but I'm just asking the question, what would a legal or a legitimate administrative process be that would fall under this this category?
Well, you know, we could probably come up with an exhaustive list that would immediately be obsolete, but we could give that a shot.
This is Mikey. Let me just jump in at this point. That was exactly the point I was going to make, which is that we run the risk of undoing the whole point of the IRTP, which was to rein in registrars that were abusing their customers by not releasing names. And if we leave the language so vague that the registrar gets to determine what the legitimate administrative process is, I share Marika's concern about that. I think we need to narrow that down a bit.
James, do you have anything you want to add?
Well, I agree with Mikey and Marika. The whole point of this was to, it was to fix a loophole. But I want to make sure that in the process of fixing it, we don't tip the pendulum too far in the other direction.
Okay. Marika.
Kevin Erdman.
Oh, Kevin, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm not on Adobe Connect, so I couldn't raise my hand. But on this point, I wanted to raise the issue that. Possibly we should not reference a quote legitimate legal process because that might be too vague. We know that the UDRP is a binding commitment that every registrar has, and so binding this language to the UDRP makes sense. But I'm not confident that every nation in the world wouldn't necessarily be subject to some sort of, quote, legal manipulation if, you know, a registrar was truly a bad registrar, particularly in a few of the countries where there are, you know, notorious bad registrars. So my comment on this would be that having a specific reference to the UDRP or the IRTP would make sense, and possibly dropping the other comment about a legal procedure, because we can just leave that up to national courts to decide what they want to do with registrars that may or may not be subject to their jurisdiction. So So that's the end of my comment.
Okay. I see Anil, Marika, and James, and I've also put myself on the queue. Anil, go ahead.
So I think let's start with the general. Paul's suggestion, I think, is the right. He has the right intentions, and then we've raised this question about whether it's too broad or ambiguous. I think it's a reasonable thing, given that we already mentioned court orders and UDRPs in the document, to simply reference court actions, court proceedings, and UDRP actions to the language that Paul was suggesting. I just want to accent one thing. I just want to make sure that the UDRP provisions, the UDRP policy, paragraph 8, it specifically references court actions as well. So I just want to make sure that we don't exclude that reference, because we should make sure we don't do anything that is so narrow that it's not really consistent with what's permitted under the UDRP policy.
Okay. James, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention to the group that as soon as new GTLDs hit the streets, they will also be bound by this. So we want to make sure that when we say UDRP, we also mean anything else that's baked into that program. And this is why I was trying to say administrative proceeding. Maybe the right word is, ICANN administrative proceeding or registry proceeding or consensus policy or something like that, because I believe that if we just say UDRP, we're probably being too limiting.
Okay.
Right. And just to echo that point that I just made, which is, you'd have to tack on what's also permitted under the EDRP, which includes court actions. That's all.
Mr. Serlin, and thank you for joining us.
Oh, you're very welcome. No, I was just going to echo what James said, actually. I think the right wording we're looking for is binding ICANN consensus policy, because that gives us the ability to basically shoehorn anything in that's that goes through the ICANN process in the future as well. I think if we leave it open to, quote, administrative proceedings, then I kind of agree with Mikey that leaves the door open for folks to say, they got served with a letter from a, local magistrate or whatever it might be that is really kind of not in the spirit of what we're trying to do here. So I think the right wording is consensus policy.
Okay, I put myself in the queue. I'm not too comfortable with it being just consensus policy, because what happens if I'm being, as a registrar, I'm being sued by a local court? That isn't covered by consensus policy, is it?
Well, that's a outstanding issue that, especially related to the UDRP, that hasn't actually been clarified. There's been issues with registrars that have had potential compliance issues for that exact issue, and it hasn't really been clarified by ICANN staff. So I don't know how we're going to try to address that, when we don't really have a clear direction from ICANN about that.
I mean, the thing we have here is, in the current policy, that as I understand it, and I could be missing something, is court order by a court of competent jurisdiction. That's fairly clear. But, generally speaking, as a company director, forget about ICANN, forget about anything else. If I'm in receipt of something that my legal counsel considers to be legitimate, I can't really ignore it. Because I have my fiduciary responsibility is going to be to the company before it is to any contract with ICANN or any other third party. So that is a headache for me.
Can Court Order 1 cover that?
It mightn't be a court order, Mikey. If I'm put on notice of an impending court or legal action surrounding something, and I can't exactly ignore it, a court order?
Maybe Amal's language is the one you want there.
Maybe, I don't know. I'm just asking. I'm just concerned that I don't want to end up in a situation where I personally help to put myself into knock myself into a corner. Marika, and then Amal.
Yeah, this is Marika. My question for you, Michaela, is like, what would you do under the current policy? Because in the language that has been added doesn't change the reasons for denial. It just talks about locking and unlocking of domains. So under the current policy, what would you do if you did receive an indication that there's a valid legal proceeding?
A valid legal proceeding in a court of competent jurisdiction is going to trump everything else.
So basically, I think as well, we should try to avoid you confuse the two things, because those reasons for denial are still there. Nothing has changed to those. I think what we're talking about is indeed the locking and unlocking, because just because a domain name is unlocked doesn't mean that a transfer goes ahead. So I think
I understand. Yeah, but that the problem there is that if I remove locks and I reject all the transfers, then I could end up in trouble as well. At least that's my understanding.
No, just for a valid reason. You're only in trouble if you're not unlocking the domain name. But if you have a valid reason that is in the IRGP for denying a transfer, as far as I can see, being a non-lawyer, you wouldn't be in trouble because you have unlocked the domain as according to the procedures, but you've also denied the transfer, which you're allowed to according to the procedures as well.
It seems a bit pointless, though. I mean, if locking and unlocking domain names is primarily a function to allow for the transfer of domain names, and yet I'm denying them, then it kind of goes back to Mikey's original point. Or maybe I'm missing something. I'm not sure. Anil, and then Mikey.
This is Anil. I think there has to be some balance between, I think, what some people have suggested, which is you don't want something that's overly broad, but yet, to Michaeli's point, you still want some flexibility because you want, let's say Michaeli's company, you want them to be able to use their judgment to say, oh, this is something that's a real thing that's happening. We can't ignore it. And I just have a second point, which is maybe we should also be guided by language that's already in the UDRP policy, the language that they refer to where you're impacted in the transfers is they use language that says during a court proceeding or arbitration. So maybe that type of language should at least be included.
Good idea. Mikey?
This is Mikey for the transcript. I think maybe what needs to happen at this point is Marika needs to take this transcript and head off and come up with a new draft that we can take a look at. One of the things that's starting to happen is we're starting to get way off the topic at hand, and I think I agree with Marika's point there. And we're getting into topics which are pretty substantially outside the scope of IRTPB. And so I think that what we need to do is sort of pay attention to the scope boundaries here. Stay zeroed in on this locking and unlocking issue. Get a new version of the language. But when we start rolling back up into other denial reasons in the IRTP, that's outside the scope of our brief, and we could dig ourselves into a quagmire if we're not careful.
Thanks, Mikey. I would tend to agree, and I see James agrees with Mikey. Okay, can we have a look at the other document then, Marika? Marika?
She's got the other document up.
Oh, okay. Just, I thought I was expecting her to say something. And you've got better eyes than me, Mikey. Okay, with respect to the other document. Oh, okay. So actually, Marika's saying to me that she is saying something. I can't hear you, Marika. You're
no, I can't either. Ah, there you go. Now it's good.
Yep. Okay. Sorry, I'm not sure what happened there.
Okay, you might want to repeat that meaningful thought that you just shared with us.
Yes. So, it is, Marika, I just wanted to very briefly say for those that haven't had a chance to review this document, I think it very much follows the line of thought that the working group has had. I think the only change or simplification that staff has suggested is that instead of associating each status value with a message, it might be easier and more straightforward to just provide a reference or a link to the document that provides the overview of all the EPP status codes that we've developed as well as part of the working group activities. The idea being as well, all the information can then be posted in a central location. Any updates that are being made can as well be done through by updating that document instead of having to change any policy documents. And it might make it easier as well on registry and registrars instead of having to attach values to each message and making sure they're all consistent. It just means providing a link or the same sentence with the WHOIS output.
Okay, thanks, Marika. James, go ahead.
Hi, Michaela, James speaking, and I have two quick comments on this section. Hopefully it's not as involved as the previous one. The first one is, how would we go about writing that document, or does it already exist? And I'm assuming there'll be some sort of drafting team put together or whatever. And then the second thing is, and maybe this is a dirty little secret of the industry, but some registrars put advertisements and links embed that into the WHOIS output, and so other registrars have programmatically stripped out HTML links out of WHOIS output to prevent competitors from stepping all over their WHOIS messages with advertisements. And I just want to make sure that if we're linking to an ICANN required and managed document, that we're at least aware of that, and we're specific about where this link needs to go, because I would hate for it to become a backdoor for people to start cramming ads back into the WHOIS. Thanks.
Thanks, James. Marika?
This is Marika. On the first point, we do have a document, and it's linked as well and referenced in the report. It's currently there as Annex F of the ITPB part final report, and I think it's currently also on the transfer page. It's on the ICANN website for those that are able to find that page. That was a document that was developed initially by, I think, with support from communication staff, reviewed by the working group. I think several of you provided input, and then basically finalized. So I think the idea is that will be the basis, but, as I think already said, the idea would be after feedback from the working group that these proposals would be put out for public comment to the broader community. So I think then there will be an opportunity as well to comment on that specific document by saying, the way it's described there makes sense, works, or other changes should be made.
Okay, I remember that document now. Thank you.
Right, and on the other question, that's something I would really need to take back to some of my colleagues, because I'm definitely not a technical expert on how that works within WHOIS and EPP. So I'll take that question back, and hopefully we'll have some feedback for the working group on that shortly.
Mr. O'Connor.
Mr. Nalan, thank you. This is Mr. O'Connor speaking. Just a caution to Marika, when you come up with the language, I think that requires a language change. James's second point, the one about pointing specifically to some place in WHOIS, I don't think that that's going to be trivially simple to figure out, and we'll probably need to take a look at that again, because we're touching the third rail, WHOIS, and we're perhaps venturing again a little bit outside of our scope. I'm not sure. So pay close attention on that one.
Okay. So you're afraid that because it involves Huawei's, it could start getting messy, basically?
Quite. Yes, absolutely. Especially given the point that James raised, which is that if we're not very careful in the way this language is crafted, we are likely to incur some pretty substantial unintended consequences from registrars who sort of drive a bus through the loophole that gets created there.
Okay. Marika?
Yeah, this is Marika. Yeah, as I said, I'll just take that point back, and I'm very aware that, you know, whenever you touch Huawei, that's a very sensitive subject, and I'm sure my colleagues are aware of that as well. So I think my objective would be to try to get a clarification to see indeed if that is a concern they share, that, you know, this change could have that as a fact that either language would get blocked, or it means indeed, you know, bringing back other effects, such as, you know, the advertising that James mentioned. So when I get some feedback, I'll share it with the list, and then maybe the working group can, you know, discuss further whether that requires further consideration or changes, or whether maybe it's less of a concern than we thought.
Okay. Does that kind of answer you, Mikey and James?
Yeah, I just wanted to, this is James speaking. I just wanted to point out that we could achieve the same thing by requiring registrars to have a link on their website, the same thing we did for the rights and responsibilities document. I think that it gets to the same thing without polluting and or corrupting.
A link to what?
This document that clarifies status symbols or the status messages. We could just have a separate link on the website of the registrar or in the registrar's registration agreement, and that way we don't pollute the WHOIS. That's just one thought.
Okay. Mikey?
This is Mikey again. I'm not terribly keen on that idea, James. Actually, part of the thing that I think is important to remember is that we want to try and keep this information as close to the WHOIS display as we can. And the original proposal was just that these clarified messages would show up in the WHOIS output. And then the proposal that's put on the table is, operationally, wouldn't it be easier to just put a link to that list in the WHOIS display? And I'm okay with that, as long as we don't step on a landmine. But when we take that link out of the WHOIS display itself, so now the person looking at WHOIS needs to know to go to the registrar's webpage and track down that link. I'm a little edgy about that, because now we're getting two hops away from the actual WHOIS display on people's screens, and that really reduces the goal of clarifying that we set out to achieve. So I'm less enthusiastic about that idea.
Can I propose an alternative?
Sure, go ahead.
That the link can appear on the same page that displays the WHOIS output, but it is not part of that output itself.
I'm thinking of Joe Grab-A-Sandwich, who's coming in with...
But will Joe Grab-A-Sandwich be using WHOIS anyway?
If I could explain, Mikey...
Yeah, go ahead.
That instead of asking each registrar to supply the link in their WHOIS output, we expect the registrar on whose website the WHOIS query was created or conducted to add the link there. And I think that ensures that no one's going to try and slip something sneaky into the WHOIS output. So, for example, if you're a registrar X and I'm a registrar Y, and someone comes to my site, does a lookup on a name that you manage, that you just give me the standard whois output, and that I add the link, as opposed to I display whatever output you give me, and the link, including possibly some other bad stuff, is included in that output. And it is a nuanced difference, but I think that it gets to what you want, and the whois status decoder ring is front and center at the time of the query, but it is not creating this hole in the fence that registrars have built to keep ads out of whois.
I get all that, but what about port 43 results?
Well, it doesn't work for port 43.
Yeah, and most
things don't.
Yeah, I know. And, you know, that's the Joe Grab a Sandwich I was thinking of, is Joe Grab a Sandwich with a terminal session open, or a person who's, you know, invoking this from a script. And suddenly, if we are putting a wrapper around it, it's that wrapping that takes us one step away from the clarification that we were trying to do.
You know, put it on the list of all the things you don't get through port 43, like IDNs.
You know, this is pretty port 43 oriented kind of stuff, and so I'm less enthusiastic about wrapping it. I think that I agree wholeheartedly that the issue you've raised is spot on, James. I don't want to create a giant loophole where people can exploit a hole. And if it means the draconian solution, which is enumerate the meanings in the whois display rather than doing a link, I'm more inclined to do that if we can't figure out a way to plug the hole. I really don't like the idea of a wrapper.
Okay. Anything else? Anybody else? Mikey?
Sorry.
Why are you apologizing?
Old hand.
Okay. Marika?
Yeah, this is Marika. So, so I said I'll take all these points back. I can discuss these internally with some of my colleagues that have been involved in developing this proposal. And then hopefully you can get back to you shortly with either some proposed modifications or clarifications on some of the questions raised. I just also wanted to highlight that there is an IRGP update scheduled to take place in Dakar. It's for now on Thursday, the 27th of October, from 10 to 11:30. And the idea would be, I'm hoping to be able to publish the final proposals from staff before that time, probably in conjunction with the public comment forum. It depends a bit on, of course, the feedback we get, and because I really would like the working group's endorsement on those proposals. But that session would also provide an update on the status of implementation of the adopted IRGP Part B recommendations, and possibly serve as well as a way to get people interested in participating in IRGP Part C. For those of you who haven't heard yet, the council decided to initiate a PDP on IRGP Part C at its meeting last week. So, of course, hoping
so
that all of you will join.
The actual start date for that, Marika, for C?
Basically, the PDP has been initiated, so I'm now setting up the wiki for that with all the information, and I'm working. I will work with Glenn to get out a call for volunteers, and then we need to see whether it's still feasible to have a first meeting prior to Dakar. I think it partly depends as well, as I'm assuming that many of the members of this working group will also be involved in the next working group, how far we get with these proposals on the table now, because I don't want to either overload people. So maybe just before Dakar, and otherwise probably relatively shortly after Dakar.
Okay. What's got a hand up there? Mikey?
This is Mikey for the record. Marika, be careful. I think that the issues that have been raised on this call today are pretty substantive. And effectively, we've only got a couple, 3 weeks before the curtain comes down on Dakar. And I kind of doubt that we're going to be able to get through all this before Dakar. So the one thing I would not want to be in is a situation where we're rushed through these just because of Dakar, because these are tricky. So just a cautionary note.
And this is a point very well taken, and, you know, this session is called an update, so the update might be as well, you know, we're still discussing these proposals. There are a number of questions that, you know, we've come across, and we need more time to go through these. I mean, in an ideal world, I hope that, you know, we might have a solution by that time, because, of course, it's a great opportunity to, you know, present the proposals and get people thinking about them there, but, you know, fully accept that if we don't manage to resolve some of the questions that have been raised today, you know, it might just be an update, I said.
Okay. All right. Any other matters, or can we call this a day? Any other final thoughts? No? Going once?
Maybe just to say, I think for now we probably don't need to schedule a next call until we get some feedback, and maybe on the basis of, you know, which direction the feedback takes us, we might need to see if another call is needed, or whether the issues can be resolved by email conversation, if everyone agrees.
Yeah, sounds perfect to me. Any other issues? No? Okay, then. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kaylee.
Thanks.
Thanks.